So really, that's what when we think about robotic vision, that's really how we view it as well, is that we want to be able to have one of these devices, and I'll hold one up here for people that are watching on the video, just a, you know, an incredibly small device like this that somebody can plug in, and they can be up and running and doing something that's meaningful in less than 10 minutes. So that's what we mean when we say we wanted to make it easy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Altium On Track podcast. I'm your host, Zach Peterson, and today we're talking with Eric Kokel, Director of Application Engineering at Luxonis, and Bradley Dillon, CEO of Luxonis. If you've seen the most recent Altium story, then you have probably been introduced to this company. They work in AI and robotic vision, and we're very happy to be talking with them on the podcast today. Bradley, Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. You are one of the few AI and robotics companies that I've had the pleasure of talking to as host of the podcast. So I think this is a great opportunity for you guys to introduce yourselves and introduce the company and what Luxonis does for anyone who has not seen the most recent Altium story.
Yeah, absolutely. So Luxonis was founded nearly 4 years ago now, in April 2019. And we were really formed around trying to solve this big enterprise pain point, which was these machine vision systems. And so these are these types of systems that engineering teams were kind of cobbling together, disparate types of hardware, trying to get the firmware to work and trying to be able to make it so that it could actually kind of solve their solve the problems that they were trying to do at scale. These types of enterprises are spending millions of dollars, and it's taking them years to be able to put these robotic vision systems into place. So when we identified that pain point, we said, gosh, we would like to be able to come along and help make robotic vision easy. And so Luxonis is we're a full stack provider. So we do hardware, firmware, software. We also do like AI and simulation. And then we have like a cloud application layer as well. So we're trying to make it so that we have this beautiful walled garden for robotics companies to be able to make the kind of the eyes and the brains part of their robot to be pretty easy. And so that they can focus on the rest of the hard stuff when it comes to, you know, developing and deploying robots in the field. So yeah, that's Luxonis.
So when you say you wanted to make it easy, it sounds to me like the pain point you were trying to solve is really that everyone was doing everything from scratch. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it absolutely nailed it. So a lot of the Luxonis team formerly worked at Ubiquiti. And so Ubiquiti is a provider of business Wi-Fi. And to be honest, it's a pretty interesting to see somewhat of a rinse and repeat from what Wi-Fi was like 20 years ago. So when somebody's putting together Wi-Fi systems, it was very difficult. You had to have somebody that was an expert, like network engineer, to be able to kind of take together these disparate systems, do a lot of tinkering to get them to work together. And then like, voila, you have Wi-Fi. And then here we are 20 years later and Wi-Fi is just a given, right? Everybody, like even grandma, grandpa, they can get Wi-Fi and they can plug it in and they can make it work. No problem. Right. And so really that's what, when we think about robotic vision, that's really, how we view it as well. Is that we want to be able to have one of these devices, and I'll hold one up here for people that are watching on the video, just a, you know, an incredibly small device like this that somebody can plug in and they can be up and running and doing something that's meaningful in less than 10 minutes. So that's what we mean when we say we wanted to make it easy.
So you've alluded to your background there just briefly. Maybe tell us a bit more how you got the idea to get started in this and what your background is like more broadly. Because I think everyone, you know, gets into these areas of not just the electronics industry, but this specific area in very interesting ways. So I always like to hear people's stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So, when we were founded, kind of our founding member was Brandon Gillis, and his background was electrical engineering, but he's also a very curious engineer, where he really, really learned and explored all of the different types of disciplines. And Luxonis today, we have, it's crazy how many engineering disciplines that we have in-house. So we have, electrical engineers, PCB layout, We have mechanical engineers, industrial design engineers, firmware engineers, software engineers, ML engineers, kind of goes on and on and on. And so when you look at our product offering, the history is that in 2020, we did a Kickstarter here, and this was called our Oak D. And so it the D stood for depth. And so this is where you have like a stereo depth pair. And it's kind of just set up very much like your eyes. And then as the product has evolved, we've moved on to like our next generation of products. And you can see visually, you can see the big improvement here on the form factor and the size of these types of devices. And so these devices have a number of sensors on them. So you can see that they have cameras, but also on the inside, they have other sensors like IMUs, microphones, and things like that. And so we're really like sensor agnostic, and it's really about being able to put a device out there in the world that can perceive the information that it needs in a way that's able to make it useful to whatever you're doing, whether that's you're actuating something or you're just need to observe something that you're sending that information somewhere else.
So you say sensor agnostic. I take that to mean that you're not developing a entire ecosystem around just your standard or your protocol or just your hardware, kind of like what Apple does, right? You have to use only Apple plugs and you have to use the Apple headphones with the iPhone and the Mac and all of that. When I hear sensor agnostic, I'm thinking, okay, I could take this vision system and plug it into or interface it with another piece of hardware that I've built for industrial production or medical or whatever other application. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it is a fair assessment. Yeah. So we're trying to support more and more sensors, more and more types of like external devices over time. So for example, in 2023, we'll be adding like time of flight support, which is something that we don't currently have today. We've done some custom, but we don't have a standard offering for it. And then over time, we want to make it so that you could take whatever the type of like external sensor you have, whether it's LIDAR, radar, sonar, I mean, it doesn't really matter, that you can feed that information into all of the AI and CV compute that's done on the device and process it in the kind of the meaningful way that you want to.
So you brought up LIDAR and radar. I think when most people think of LIDAR and radar, they don't really think of it as a vision or imaging technology, but as you know, the scan rate and resolution have improved over time, it really has become an imaging technology. So I'm hearing a lot of imaging applications and imaging sensors, but then you also mentioned stuff like IMUs. Are there other sensors that someone could create support for, I guess you could say, in your product? Or let's say someone wanted to integrate a sensor, do they have to then like take in the digital data with a different control system, send the digital data into your unit, and then use that in the AI model to then try and do inference?
Yeah, can you take that one, Eric?
Yeah, sure. So currently we support about 30 different camera sensors. So you can use them directly, feed the MIPI lanes directly to the SoC. That runs all the AI, the CV, and then do the processing together with our inside our ecosystem. So for any kind of different sensors, currently we have to add support into the firmware, so it's supported. In the next generations of our hardware, it will be even more agnostic because customers will have access to the full image, so they would be able to add the kernel, the drivers to the image themselves without our help. So they would be able to take our devices, take, for example, a thermal imager and support it themselves and create a whole solution on top of that.
Very interesting. And I think one thing about building a platform like this is, you know, you have mentioned in the Altium story about your platform is that a lot of it is open source. Why did you choose to go the open source route with like your firmware and some of the other aspects of your platform?
Yeah, it's a great question. So And just to clarify, so there are two aspects of the platform that are closed source. One of them is the source code for our firmware, and then the other one is the kind of the chip down design for our system on modules. But everything else is open source. So if you want to go look at like the PCB layouts, if you want to look at the mechanical designs, if you're looking at other aspects of like the software and the AI, you can find all of that like on our GitHub. It's all open source. And our thinking here was really is that that what robotic vision unlocks is like new markets, new industries, new applications. And it's definitely not like a, you know, a winner take all type of view for us. We believe that anything that we can do to help get these sort of devices out there will create these new industries that will then flow back into, you know, future hardware sales. So it's really an intentional decision there. That by open sourcing there, we can really like accelerate the adoption of these type of devices out there in the world. And we think that's ultimately a win-win because it helps take like kind of the engineering efficiency that we can help provide. And it helps provide that like improved productivity to enterprises. And then obviously at the end of the day, we fashion ourselves as a software company that monetizes when we sell hardware. We just want to sell a lot of hardware. And so by getting these out there, it helps us sell a lot of hardware.
Because the hardware is open source, that has helped numerous customers to actually leverage the open source designs and then build their solutions on top of ours, which just, you know, accelerates the progress and time to market, which also benefits both the customer and us because we're able to sell the hardware faster.
Normally when a hardware design goes open source, people use it as a reference design. So like, for example, the big semiconductor vendors, they'll create a reference design and, maybe they have to put a little bit of effort into it to make sure that it works on the front end. But the whole point is like to sell their chips. And for you guys putting your PCB layout out there like that for free, it almost seems like you are kind of giving away the best part of your product. You don't normally see companies doing that with their PCB layouts. So how does that fit into the company's strategy to scale out and really become a leader in this space?
Definitely. So we offer a number of our standard Oak type of devices here, like you see that I'm holding up for those looking at the video. But we also offer system on modules. And so that's a piece of hardware that we sell. And so the system on module is something where it's like this here, where you're connecting onto a baseboard. And the system on modules today, they don't make up a large portion of our sales. But we actually think long term that one of the biggest drivers of our hardware sales will be the system on modules. And so the system on module, just kind of like has this all kind of the of our core tech on it, and the customer can just use it to plug and play into their larger PCB layout, into whatever form factor that they have, so they're able to custom integrate it into their kind of finished solution. So that's where we still get the benefit from it, even though it's not like our broader design, it's the customer's design. We still have the system on module that's plugging in there.
I see. Okay. And as part of the open source component to this, when Bradley, when you and I had talked previously, I believe you had said that some of the AI models are also put out there as open source. Is that correct?
Yeah. Can you speak to that one a little bit more, Eric?
Yeah, correct. So we do have all the notebooks for the training. So the AI training, then also AI conversion and AI deployment onto our hardware. We have all of that open source just so the customers can easily develop their own model and then deploy it on the device itself. Besides that, we also have the model zoo, so just the trained AI models that customers can just use out of the box with our system.
And one of the paradigms in AI at the edge, or AI on embedded systems or small devices these days, has been training in the data center, inference on the edge. And so when you make a model available like this for users, essentially they could, you know, run this on the edge device. But I believe you just said training, so you can do training on these devices as well.
So the training notebooks usually will be done on either the cloud or on the computer itself. So the host computer that the developers use, and then deploy it the trained model on the device.
Okay, so this is fitting with the standard paradigm where essentially training in the cloud, deploy it to the end device, and then infer on the end device.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then one thing I noticed on your device, Bradley, when you were holding up one of those boards, you got a big heat sink attached to that board. So just looking at it, I can see this thing probably uses its fair share of power and puts out a lot of heat as a result. Are there any plans to maybe procure an alternate chipset, or are you hoping that the vendor for that chipset will become more power efficient over time so that these devices can get further miniaturized?
Yeah, it's a great question. So our first generation of products, our Series 1, we were not thermal experts at all. So we basically said, we're just going to make these massive overkill. I don't even know if we simulated it, but we basically said, oh, we'll make these really big, we'll test it. And, oh, look, it works. So let's put that out there into the world. And so for our Series 2 of products, you can see that for those looking at camera, the thermal fins have gotten much, much smaller because we got a lot more confidence. And now we do have, you know, mechanical engineers that are doing like thermal simulations to be able to check this sort of thing. The power draw on these types of devices is actually pretty low. So for the models that I was holding up there, the kind of USB-C connectivity, it provides both the power and the data connectivity. And those type of devices, depending on what you're doing, are typically drawing like 3 to 5 watts, which is relatively low. And then for some of our power over Ethernet devices, the power draw typically is in like the 5 to 7 watt range, kind of depending on what you're doing. But the devices also can be optimized to have like a low power mode, kind of like a sleep mode where they're, you know, drawing less than 1 watt. And then they can kind of come online when they need to. So like the total power that you're consuming over time isn't that bad. And then the area with thermal that we've had to get more advanced on is the kind of the outdoor environment. And so this is where, you know, you're in the sunshine, you're in, you know, Arizona, and it's, you know, 45 degrees centigrade. And in those types of environments, it's really difficult from a heat perspective. And so in that case, sometimes we're, you know, adding things like, okay, how can we get like a custom hood to be able to prevent the sun and stuff like that? We've improved a lot with thermal over time as we've evolved.
What you just mentioned about throwing heat sink at the device until it gets cool enough and then iterating on that. I think a lot of engineers will take that approach, but then they don't do the iteration, which is to then try and optimize the thermal management strategy, whatever that looks like, for space. And so from what you just held up in that one, looked like version 2 of your product, you actually integrated the heat sink into the enclosure. So in doing that, how does that affect the form factor of the board? You're able to just essentially just shrink down the board on the Z axis and do what? Attach it directly to the enclosure. You have like a thermal interface material in there to then draw heat into the enclosure and then into the fins.
Yeah, that's exactly how we're doing it. So both for the main SoC that runs the AI and also some other components like the power management components have the thermal layer between the enclosure and them for efficient thermal dissipation.
And so I'm sure anyone could then maybe use a fan if they're in a larger system. Maybe they deploy this as like an accelerator in a data center for something. They could then do whatever cooling strategy they want to ensure that they at least keep the thing operating within safe temperature limits without blowing out their form factor.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, some customers even had a really thin fins, so not as big, just because of the weight and the size, on specifically on some drone applications. And then they had, because they already had active cooling, which then provided good enough heat dissipation.
That's interesting. You bring up drone applications. I had not thought of that. I was actually going to ask next, what are some of the applications that you're seeing? And I kind of figured the common ones like automotive, and then I think you guys have mentioned industrial robotics earlier, which makes total sense. But what are some of the application areas that you're seeing, and which ones do you think are most interesting or maybe most unexpected?
Yeah, we're obsessed with all of them. It's probably one of the funnest parts of the job is Eric and I will get on a sales call and we'll go, wow, like I had no idea that you were possibly doing this with a vision system. I'll give an example. Recently, we had a call with a company that helps people operate beehives for honey production. And these beehives will get inundated with mites. And so the mites will actually kind of like they attach onto the bee and then they make them sick. And so then the people that operate these beehives, they need to be able to provide the bees with some kind of chemicals that kill the mites, but they don't really want to use it. And so what they are actually able to do, they're not using our system, but they're using a vision system today, is they're actually with a camera, they're able to count how many mites are on a bee. And then they're able to know like basically what is the what's the density of mites per, you know, bee count. And then they can know the exact right time when the right before like the curve of where the number of mites is just going to explode, then they can provide the chemicals and they can make it so that the mites die, and then they can keep their bees, you know, happy and healthy. And so this is one of these like off the wall examples where you're like, I had no idea that this type of application occurred. But to, you know, more directly answer your question, the type of industries that we're getting the most traction in, I'd say one of them would be the kind of the retail and warehouse automation case. And so there's a lot of aspects of retailing and warehousing, and also kind of ties into logistics as well, kind of transportation and logistics, just the movement of goods and the automation of stuff that previously was done by a human that needs to be kind of assisted by a robot. I'd say that's a huge industry that we're seeing a lot of traction in. Another one I would say is the kind of the industrial equipment. So kind of think like, say, like agricultural, industrial machinery, stuff like that. We're getting a lot of traction there. You may have seen recently the actor Jeremy Renner at his kind of snow cabin. He got run over by his big snow plow. And you think about that and you go, okay, there's two like major problems here that is occurring to make it so that Jeremy Renner could get hurt here. One, why does he even need to be in the snowplow to start with? This is a big, expensive piece of equipment. He should be able to have a remote control to operate it, or it should be completely autonomous altogether. And then the second piece is that why, if Jeremy Renner's standing in front of the snowplow, is it just willing to drive him over? Like it should be able to see him and it should be able to know, oh, I don't want to drive over a human. And so those are kind of some examples of where, you know, with machine guarding and automation, you can make that kind of this big industrial equipment operate way more efficiently, but like way more safe in terms of, you know, not harming humans.
I would have never guessed beekeeping was one of the applications, but I asked for unexpected. So there you go. That's definitely unexpected. So you brought up power over Ethernet earlier for interfacing with one of these devices. The area where I have seen power over Ethernet for imaging and vision, or even for radar most recently, come up is in security, and specifically like facilities security, campus security, and then some applications in defense. Have you been seeing that type of application area come up for you guys at all recently?
Yeah, we have. And so it actually ties into kind of like that retail automation use case. And so you think about a retail store, and some of them are like really big format. We were actually in Las Vegas for CES a couple of weeks ago, and I went to a Walmart for the first time in a while. And oh my gosh, like it took me a half an hour to find five items because the store is so freaking big. One of those super centers. And so you think of a store like that, it's kind of perfect for power over Ethernet. you can have really long cables. You could have a cable that's, say, 300 meters long, and it's all connecting back into some central location to give you a lot more processing power. And in that type of application, there's all kinds of things all kinds of use cases in retail that can be really helpful. So some of it is to be able to like to detect bad actors. You know, shrinkage is a big thing that retailers are complaining a lot more about lately. That's really harming their bottom line. So you can prevent that. You can also do some stuff that's pretty exciting for like the marketeers of the world. Is that you could do proximity-based stuff. Is somebody near a display that's meaningful in a way that we want to maybe serve them up an ad? Or we could actually like say it's a digital display and we could, you know, if there's a few people that are looking at it, maybe we could go ahead and like serve up some type of a demo or something that's, you know, interesting or meaningful to them. And then another piece of it is actually just the automation. So, you know, Amazon with Just Walk Out technology really pioneered that. I used to live in Seattle and you loved it, right? You scan your palm, you walk in, you grab what you want, and then you walk right out. And so I think that's really the future of retail is that it's kind of more of an experience, which these kind of camera devices connect over power over Ethernet can provide. But then also it's automated. So you just, you know, you grab the items you want, you walk out, and then you just, you know, you get your receipt later.
I think the technical term that you had brought up earlier was loss prevention. Is that how it's been described to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So when it comes to like brick and mortar theft, it's a big challenge. I mean, warehouse theft is an issue as well, but they're able to kind of keep that a little bit, more under control. But brick and mortar theft is a big problem. In the most recent like quarterly earnings reports, multiple retailers cited it as a major drag to their bottom line. And they're struggling with, in particular, say America, they're struggling to be able to police theft, and they're trying to find more efficient ways to be able to like identify and prevent it kind of on the early end of it. So yeah, it's a big challenge that, you know, our type of devices can definitely help solve.
So I think that's a really interesting use case, and just to dig into it a little bit more, because it's not just like object identification, but it's really like classification among, I think, what would have to be a set of sequences of video in order to, you know, maybe identify what could possibly be theft. So your system has to capture all of this data from multiple sensors, in this case, multiple cameras, bring it all together, and then do not just the object identification, but also the classification based on a stream of images from multiple sources. How much of that are you doing on the device versus what has to happen in the external system or the broader system that it has to interface with?
That's usually, to describe this, it's usually used action recognition. And so for some basic models, like, for example, basic human actions, like if a person is sitting or standing or raising hand, that's a simple model and it can be run on the camera itself. For more complex models, in general, edge computing isn't the best, and you need the big systems with big GPUs to be able to run those models at a high resolution.
Sure, I could understand that. I mean, I think once you have to link together a lot of data over multiple time frames, it makes more sense to do it in a server. And really, it sounds like the camera in that place or in that type of application is doing some pre-processing, number one. And then number two, almost like automated tagging of data. So in this case, tagging of the image data that comes in. Is that an appropriate way to think of it?
Yeah, that's actually quite correct. So usually what people do is they do some pre-processing. So for example, initial object detection. So for example, detect the person, crop the high resolution image from the high resolution, for example, 12 megapixel color camera, and then stream just that to the cloud, which then saves a bunch of bandwidth, which is the main pro of having some AI computation on the edge. to then save on the bandwidth cost.
Okay, so let's take that architecture for a moment and find its analog in something like automotive, right? With automotive, you may have to do some kind of action recognition or action classification because things are dynamic. They're happening in real time. I mean, there's, of course, the object recognition. So identify whether the thing in front of the car is a human or an animal or a stop sign, let's say. Those are kind of the obvious ones. But then to really predict what the vehicle has to do next, I think it then has to be able to predict what's going on around it based on a set of data that may not all have been gathered at the same time. And in something like automotive, the processing time and the time required to get to a decision has to be really low because, you know, milliseconds worth of time is a lot of braking distance if it comes out that the car needs to, you know, slam on the brakes. And I mean, it really could be the difference between, you know, someone's, you know, saving someone's life. So because of that, it seems to me that you need to bring some of that more powerful inference capability out of the cloud and into the vehicle in order to get the latency that you need. So what would that look like in a vehicle if someone was trying to use your system for that type of application? Do they have to have like a cellular connection to the cloud, or can it be done in the vehicle with the right back-end processing? Because if someone's in, you know, one of our previous guests brought this up, if someone's in rural America and they're relying on the cloud for inference in that kind of safety system, you know, maybe they don't even have a connection, or maybe they do have a connection, but it's a slow connection.
I think it really depends on the application itself. So for some applications, it's fine if you completely rely on the cloud and the whole application would work without it. Of course, there would be some fallbacks, some other systems. And then for some other applications, the connectivity isn't really required. And there's a powerful host computer on the somewhere around the device. So initial computation would happen on the camera, so on our cameras, and then further computation would be done in the host. For example, that would be 2 meters away from it.
So someone's basically bringing like a small black backplane with a blade server or something into the vehicle to then do all of this, you know, processing without having to send everything up to the cloud.
Yeah, for example, for robotics application, usually you'll have quite a powerful computer that would then take all the sensor information and then output all the actuators. So the motors, robotic arms, stuff like that.
So I think that type of architecture maybe then brings up what you guys might want to do in the future. Where do you see the future of your products going? And do you see yourselves developing maybe a suite of products to target some of these higher compute areas where someone might have to rely on the cloud, but you could bring some of that more processing, you know, that greater processing capability and power closer to the end device for some of these applications where, you know, time sensitivity is very important?
Yeah, definitely. So we've recently been rolling out our Series 3 of products, and to really kind of demonstrate the kind of the new capabilities that we have for Series 3, we actually created our first robot, which we're not trying to be a company that makes robots, but we wanted to be able to create one to kind of show what Series 3 can do. And so what Series 3 unlocks that the previous generations did not have is it actually has a quad-core ARM A53 running Yocto Linux. And so it makes it so that you can kind of be the host controller of other devices. And so in the case of the little robot that we have, for those of you on video, this is what this cute little robot looks like. It's pretty small here, so it has 5 cameras. But down here, it's actually controlling like 2 motors. And then with the USB-C, you can connect it to, like, you could, for example, have an arm that's on top of this. And so That helps kind of evolve our types of devices to really kind of be like the eyes and the brain behind robotic systems that we mentioned. Previously, it's kind of more like the eyes and somewhat of the brain, but now being able to have the Linux running on it, it really makes it so you can control, you know, control other devices with it. And then we're crazy. We're trying to come up with a new series of products every year. We're already working on our Series 4. And so Series 4 will build on the same things as what Series 3 has, but then have quite a bit more power when it comes to both processing power, but then also the ability to do quite a bit more TOPS when it comes to like AI inference. So in our view, kind of really the future is that to try to stay ahead of like the hardware improvement curve of constantly being able to have more processing power, more AI inference. And that's really going to be, you know, our primary focus. The other piece that we're excited to be rolling out right now that kind of goes along, goes hand in hand with this is our cloud application layer. And so this makes it so that you can much more easily manage kind of a fleet of these devices at scale. So that cloud application layer is called Robot Hub. And there's a number of like free applications that will be available there. But then third-party developers could also put their own applications there. And this would be somewhere where you could, do things like stream the data, do A/B testing, stuff like that.
Interesting. So you're putting, when you say you want to be the entire brain, what I'm really hearing is you could have a broader application that makes use of the AI in some innovative way. And that broader application is going to then allow someone to tailor the device to whatever their end use case is.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, as it rolls out, I hope to have you guys on again. I know we're getting a little up there on time, but I definitely want to have you guys on here again to show what your products can do, because I think this area is so interesting. And, you know, embedded AI is something that I've become passionate about over the past few years. And so I hope some of our listeners will have some of that passion rub off on them and we'll go learn more about Luxonis.
Yeah, it'd be great. We'd love to come back. It's obviously a topic that's near and dear to our heart. And yeah, we could talk about it all day long.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. To everyone that's out there listening, we've been talking with Eric Kokol, Director of Applications Engineering, and Bradley Dillon, CEO, both from Luxonis. For those watching on YouTube, make sure to subscribe. You'll keep up to date with all of our episodes and tutorials as they come out. And of course, we'd like to remind you all to watch the most recent Altium story about Luxonis. We will link to that in the show notes so you can go take a look. I watched it this morning again. It's a great video, and I encourage you all to go watch it as well. Finally, everyone that's listening, don't stop learning, stay on track, and we'll see you next time.